and the Family and Social Services Administration. Versus Department of Health and Human Services.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, good morning. My name is Mary Beth Claus. I'm with the law firm of Baker & Daniels, and I'm here on behalf of EDS. I'm joined today by Francis Barrow from the Indiana Attorney General's Office, here on behalf of the state. We are here to seek a reversal of the erroneous decision of the District Court to uphold the federal government's decision to certify the Indiana AIM system with a starting date of June 17, 1995, as opposed to the actual operational date of February 5, 1995. We are here to challenge an ad hoc interpretation by the Secretary that a new claims processing system that is suspending unclean claims for adjudication and further correction is a system that is not processing all claim types. We believe that the Secretary's ad hoc interpretation is arbitrary, capricious, unsupported by law, and leads to the unreasonable conclusion that the state of Indiana should be denied its fair share of federal monies for the millions of claims that were processed during the time period in question, because 2% of those claims were lawfully suspended so that corrections could be made and paid on time. The standard of deference afforded the Secretary in this case is governed by the case of U.S. versus Meade, which was actually determined 2 months after the District Court's decision below. In fact, this case before you, Your Honors, is very similar to the case of Matz versus Household International Tax, which this court decided in September of last year. When Matz was first...
How much money is that stake here? I'm having a hard time getting a handle on it.
And the record is difficult on that issue, Your Honor. It's a little over $2 million.
And that $2 million represents the difference between what Indiana got paid during that period of time, according to the feds, and what Indiana thinks they should get paid by having a better system in place, and getting this enhanced. I mean, Indiana still gets its administrative cost, but doesn't get the enhanced administrative cost for having this system until June, whatever, 17th or something.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor.
And the difference is about $2 million.
Correct, and it's for the second quarter of 1995.
It's February to June.
Well, actually, we would qualify for that enhanced funding the first day of the next quarter after the certification date.
Okay.
So the time period in question is the second quarter.
All right. And that $2 million... Another question. That $2 million is really just a small portion of the total amount that we're talking about here as far as reimbursement to the state of Indiana.
That is right. And in fact, when the date was originally set in November of 1995, the total amount was approximately $6 million. So it has been reduced from there.
So it represents a difference between 50% and 75% reimbursement.
For the second quarter, correct, Your Honor.
Reimbursement of the administrative costs.
Of the administrative costs.
Not of the claims themselves.
Right. The claims themselves, we were reimbursed at 63% pursuant to our per capita income formula.
Okay. Thanks.
What is your best argument that the operating continuously requirement of the regulation is inconsistent with the plain language of the statute?
Well, Your Honor, as is the case with most of these cases of interpretation, the statute, the regulation, and the guidelines each get more specific. The statute itself allows for this enhanced funding for a system that is operating. The regulation then says that you are entitled to enhanced funding if the system is operating continuously. The Secretary has then refined that in the state Medicaid manual to say that the system has to be operating continuously, processing all claim types. Contrary to what counsel has asserted, we are not challenging the regulation, nor are we challenging a reasonable construction of the Medicaid manual. What we are challenging is the Secretary's interpretation that operating continuously means paying continuously, that you cannot suspend claims so that they can be corrected. That interpretation directly conflicts with other provisions in the state Medicaid manual about the requirements of the claim subsystem. At page 245, I believe, in the appendix, is a description from the state Medicaid manual of the six subsystems that must make up a claims processing system. One of those subsystems is claims processing. Under that specific provision, and I quote, the system must automatically suspend all transactions in error until corrections can be made, close quote. It is our belief that this manual is really only stating the obvious, that the state is not going to receive only clean claims that should be paid immediately. Now, we would admit that a clean claim with correct information for covered services should be paid promptly. But the reality is that error or that claims are received that result in the an error in the transaction all the time. These claims.
What happens if the machine breaks down?
Well, Your Honor, it would be my contention then that the system is not operating. That there is a difference between performing functions that are a part of the reality, if you will, of claims processing and simply not functioning at all.
Would they not pay the additional amount then if it broke down? Under their theory?
Under their theory, the enhanced funding would stop.
Yeah. Interesting.
But it's this, again, this reality of what you normally receive when you're processing claims day in and day out, and the necessity that there will be claims in which there needs to be further development.
Does the government pay promptly and continuously on their on the claims that are submitted to them?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't understand the question.
Well, you submit a claim to them. Do they process them promptly in the form that they require you to process your claims?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Boy, you paused at the threshold of a brilliant finding.
Counsel, but you didn't begin to process those crossover claims until June 17th, did you?
No, Your Honor, we began the process.
All right. It's claimed that its system was operating continuously. Then since February, how do you justify that?
The way I justify it, Your Honor, is that all of the claims received, beginning on February 5, all of the claims received were loaded into the system and processing was started. At a point in February, an edit was put into the system whereby when the system was presented with a crossover claim, what it did was suspend that claim to a unique location, if you will, within the system, so that that claim could be researched and the numbers reconciled if necessary.
But it wasn't operating properly, was it?
No, according to the state Medicaid manual, Your Honor, it was.
To the federal regs.
Pardon me?
To the federal regs, you weren't operating between February and June, were you?
No, we were, Your Honor, because of the fact that claims were being loaded, the processing was started, and what we were doing was simply what the reg requires.
Federal reg required.
The federal reg required,
right.
Correct.
Yes.
That a claim in which the transaction, there was an error in some fashion, would be suspended and corrected. During that time period, processing continued. Those claims didn't simply stop. According to the
fact... Why did it stop?
Well, because what was being done at that time, Your Honor...
Was improper.
Was correction of the transaction.
Doing what the federal regulations required you to do.
Exactly. So it is our contention that during this time period, processing did not stop, and in fact, the Medicaid manual supports that very theory. Further, if you look at the state Medicaid manual, not only is suspension and correction part of the normal processing cycle, the manual recognizes that that error can occur from a number of different venues. It specifically says that you must correct an error and pay it, regardless of whether the error occurs from the provider, from the state agency, from the system, or from its data. It doesn't matter. The fact is that you have to have a means to correct that claim and process it to conclusion, and that's exactly what we did in this case. The inconsistencies in the Secretary's interpretation, however, does not end with the theory of processing. As stated in the brief, there is no dispute that the correction and processing of all of these claims had occurred and was finished by June of 1995. This processing occurred within the six-month time frame required by federal law for crossover claims. In the past, the Secretary has contended that the interpretation of timeliness is irrelevant to the question of enhanced federal funding. However, in the brief submitted to this court, and specifically on page 32, counsel admits that timeliness is, in fact, a component of enhanced federal funding. We're not here to contend, Your Honors, that the state and EDS could have been given an unspecified period of time to process claims. What we are here to say is that the six-month time frame for crossover claims is the only standard contained in federal law. There is no support in the law, and there is no support in the record for any type of heightened standard which would require a faster processing time than the six-month time frame given. For this additional reason, we think the Secretary's interpretation is arbitrary.
Well, Judge Hamilton held that the delay of processing 250,000 such claims, AR 239 reporting the number of Part B claims to process, this is the first time, that the Secretary did not act arbitrarily nor capriciously in finding that processing such a small fraction of those claims and then suspending all processing of such claims for several months did not satisfy the requirement of operating continuously and processing all claims. Isn't that what he found?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
And why was he in error?
He was in error because in finding that, Your Honor, he was giving Chevron-like deference to the Secretary's interpretation. His decision was handed down 2 months prior to Meade. We believe when the proper standard, as found by this court in Matz, is applied, the Secretary's interpretation is entitled to no deference. It's inconsistent with the statute, the regulation, the state Medicaid manual. It also lacks the type of validity and persuasiveness that is necessary for that kind of deference.
No deference. Entitled to less, maybe less than.
Where are you getting that from? No, it's deference. Entitled to no deference.
Well, under...
That's the Indiana...
That would be our position. Now, I recognize in Meade and in Matz, this court specifically found there are levels of deference.
Sure.
Depending
right.
upon the method right. used to interpret the statute. It would be our contention that in this case, the Secretary is entitled to no deference because of the inconsistencies, the lack of validity, and the lack of persuasiveness.
You're eating up your rebuttal time now.
Your Honor, and I will wait. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Constance Wynn. I'm from the Department of Justice, Civil Division Appellate Staff, representing the Secretary in this case. Opposing counsel has obfuscated what is really a very simple APA case involving the arbitrary, capricious standard. Plaintiff ignores a long line of Supreme Court precedent and even this Court's decision in Paragon as to the analysis to be applied to an APA case review of agency decision where there is a promulgated regulation. Starting with Chevron, starting with Skidmore, Seminole Rock, Jefferson, all those Supreme Court cases say that where the Secretary has interpreted a regulation, that regulation is entitled to controlling weight. Interestingly enough, opposing counsel completely ignores the Secretary's decision in this case. Opposing counsel erroneously states that the Secretary's decision is based on the manual. That is completely wrong. Of course, the manual was considered. However, if this court reads the Secretary's decision, what the Secretary said was it interpreted the regulation operating continuously to mean that when you have a computer system, a new computer system, you turn the switch on, the computer system doesn't work. There are systemic problems with the computer. Opposing counsel in their briefs would have you think that it was a simple matter of missing numbers.
Well,
but the Secretary specifically found that there was a problem.
Hold on. I get to ask a question occasionally.
Yes, you do.
What, if the machine broke down, would the same result apply? That is, the perfectly good machine, everything's working fine, it breaks down sometime, the penalty kicks in, they don't get the 75%?
I don't know how the agency would deal with that situation, but that is not the situation we have here. This is a situation where the Secretary, Congress gave the Secretary the authority to determine when a state is entitled to the enhanced rate of 75%.
And wait, it is an absolute, that authority.
Excuse me?
The authority, you don't claim to be absolute, do you?
Well, if the under the...
Have you just decided the hell that he wasn't going to let him pay the 75%? That would be the end of that?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Well, I thought it was fairly simple. I said his authority to decide is not exactly total. I mean, it's not...
Of course, it's subject to this court's review. But the statute...
You just, as near as I thought, what you told us, we didn't have any right to review it, neither did the trial.
Oh, no, that's not what I'm saying, Your Honor. I'm saying the statute gives the... Congress gave the Secretary the authority to promulgate the regulations.
No question.
The Secretary has promulgated the regulations.
Yes,
the Secretary has interpreted regulation, and what this court's job is to do is determine whether or not the regulation is reasonable.
If the regulation is reasonable or is the application of the regulation is not arbitrary?
Both. If the Secretary's construction and application of the regulation is reasonable. And in this case, it is, Your Honor, because Congress intended for the 75% enhanced rate to be a special rate. If you have a computer system that has problems, it's not to say they're not going to get reimbursed. They're going to get reimbursed at the 50% rate. But what good does it... It's contrary to the intent of the
statute. Isn't there a regulation that says when there's an error, they have to pull the files out and recalculate them before they can run them through?
I'm not specifically sure whether there's a regulation. There is something in the manual that says that. But
well,
Your Honor,
who promulgates the manual? Who prepares it?
The agency does.
The Secretary.
Yes, the Secretary does. But
so he's preparing the same manual for that we're talking about, the same guy that does that, or was responsible for it, is for the application of the 50-75% rule.
Where the manual comes in, Your Honor, if I can back up a little bit, is that if this court determines that the agency's construction of the regulation is reasonable, this court can then turn to the manual and apply the analysis of Mead and this court's decision in Mays. The Mead case and all the cases before that, where the Supreme Court applied the Skidmore analysis, occurred in cases where there was not a statute that clearly applied to the situation, or there was no regulation.
Well, the statute applies to the situation if the Secretary has determined that.
Right.
So the statute isn't the only thing we look to. We look to what the decision of the Secretary is.
Right. You're right, but your court has to start with the regulation.
Oh, I have no question about that. Right?
Exactly. And then, therefore, starting with the regulation.
So does he.
Exactly. This court must give a controlling weight. It's not to say that it's the only interpretation, but if this court concludes that it's a reasonable interpretation, then it has to be given controlling weight. Then it can turn to the manual and say, what deference does it do to the extent it's inconsistent with the regulation? The manual, then, the court applies the analysis of Skidmore, where what type of respect is it entitled to? What level of deference? And in this case, we maintain the manual is consistent. Sure, it provides more detail, but what it does is support the agency's construction of the regulation. And it's similar to, it's dissimilar to this. I would urge this court's decision in Paragon, I think, is controlling here, and the Supreme Court's analysis in Thomas Jefferson is controlling in this case. And in that case, where the parties tried to bring in informal memoranda, the court basically viewed it as supportive to the extent it was consistent with the regulation. But what opposing counsel would have you say, she opened up her argument stating, this is an ad hoc procedure. How can it be ad hoc if we're interpreting a regulation? And the Supreme Court has said, regulations are to be given the effect of law unless the regulation is plainly erroneous or the secretary's construction is inconsistent with the wording of the regulation. The wording of the regulation says operating continuously.
What she said was that the secretary's interpretation kept them, was erroneous only because, or was arbitrary only because it ignored another regulation that they were required to comply with.
No, what she's saying is that it was erroneous because...
Well, she'll get another crack at it.
Because of the manual. And then the critical problem with her argument is also this, Your Honor, that this court must realize. If the manual is entitled to no deference, then what's this court going to look at? It still is going to have to return to the regulation and interpret what Congress intended. And there again, to the extent operating continuously is ambiguous, the secretary is entitled to deference. We have a computer system here that is supposed to function when it goes live for the first time. If it doesn't function, and the court specifically found that it was more than just a matter of missing numbers, but that it was a problem with the system itself. It made that specific factual finding, and it also determined that the crossover complaint, its inability to process the crossover claims was critical. And
what
another...
What caused the department to move this date back from... Originally it was November,
right.
And then it was moved back to some date in June, and moved back another week in June. So the department must have had new information to rely on to say that it was operating continuously of June, although originally we thought as of November. Why did the department change its position?
The original date of November, the court revised, the HCFA revised this decision because it was, there were so many things, it determined that it needed to focus on a specific event to determine the operating continuously standard. So the court's decision, the revised decision, is not the final decision of the secretary. That's just HCFA's determination. And what the secretary said was that the revised decision of HCFA, where the HCFA said if the system is not able to operate, process in the routine claims in the normal flow, it's not operating consistently. Now, in terms of the difference between the June the 17th and June 25th, I think that's just a minor point, Your Honor, in that it's when the system actually began to function properly in terms of the crossover claims is the date there. And that's just the beginning of the week versus the end of the week.
All the disputes that percolate up on this issue relating to startup when it's ready to go, has there ever been a case where, like Judge Bauer's example, of a computer just crashing for a couple of days or something like that?
Well, you have to look at this in the context. This was a new system just starting up. If the system crashes initially, of course it's not operating continuously. Now, if it's been operating continuously and functioning appropriately for a year and it goes down for a day, I don't know how the secretary would construe that, but that is not the facts of this case. But this case, what this court decides in this case is going to be critical for how this Seventh Circuit construes administrative law. And I would urge this court to look at its decision in Paragon, look at the Supreme Court's decision in Thomas and Jefferson, and those set forth the analysis.
We pretty generally follow the Supreme Court insofar as we're able to piece our way through it.
Well, Mead was meant to clarify everything. In some respects, it confused things. But if the court reads it, it only applies where there's no regulation. Never does it apply in that line of cases prior to that, where there is a regulation that applies to the facts of the case. Are there no further questions?
Do you need any other time?
I think I addressed most of my, I've addressed all the issues.
All right.
Your Honor.
I just wanted to know because you had been asked a lot of questions.
Pardon me?
You had been asked a lot of questions.
The department views this as a very important case.
I wanted to get your whole argument out, that's all.
Excuse me? Yes, I did get my whole argument out.
Fine.
And
thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Your Honor, the Secretary is urging you to follow the precedent of cases that were actually decided before the Meade decision, both Paragon and Thomas Jefferson, we would contend that this court needs to look no further than its analysis it used in Matz, in that it is very similar. We are not here, again, to dispute the regulation, to call the regulation or the statute ambiguous. We are not here to dispute that the state Medicaid manual sets out in detail what is expected of a claims processing subsystem. What you're hearing the Secretary doing is trying to run from the manual and run from the details and the requirements that have been set in place that the state and EDS have complied with. The Secretary's ad hoc interpretation of the law under Meade and under Matz is subject to deference only to the extent that it is persuasive, consistent, valid, and thorough. The biggest point in contention here, Your Honor, is how inconsistent the Secretary's ad hoc interpretation is with the details that were promulgated in the state Medicaid manual. We simply cannot win under the Secretary's theory. We followed the manual, but now we're told there is a heightened standard for enhanced federal funding. But you will notice you were given no citation in the record or in the law to support that theory. The Secretary's interpretation also fails to meet other important considerations under Meade and Matz. The state and EDS now find themselves in a situation in which the federal government is attempting to penalize them for what was a practical and wise management decision that the federal government now assesses in hindsight to run contrary to some heightened standard, again, that can't be found in the law. The Secretary has never disputed that the claims at issue represent 2% of 13 million claims that were processed during this time period, that the claims were suspended for correction, and that they were paid on time. If you look at the legislative history of the statute, the federal government was one of the clear beneficiaries of this type of system, despite the fact
that's why they pay 90% of the cost of the startup.
Exactly correct. They wanted a more efficient and a system in which primarily beneficiaries who got their Medicare notices and Medicaid notices would know exactly what it meant. They were too confusing at the time. And the thought was that an automatic claims processing system would make that type of system easier and more efficient for beneficiaries. We believe that the Secretary's interpretation runs afoul of that legislative history, that it's inconsistent with the statute, that it's inconsistent with the regulations and his own manual. For that reason, it is arbitrary, capricious, not in accordance with the law. We would ask this court to reverse the district court and enter a finding that the AIMS system should be certified as of February 5, 1995. Thank you so much for your time.
Do you need any extra time?
I do not.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We will proceed to case number